Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton reporting for duty. Now, joining you on the bridge, Cam, or joining you on stage?
Wow, that's profound.
It takes us back to just a few short weeks ago, does it not? When we were in Las Vegas, Nevada, at the Rio Hotel, one of my favorite hotels.
The greatest of all hotels.
Such class.
Forget it, Taj Mahal.
Yes. Of course, we were doing our live Subspace Transmissions panel up on stage. And I think what we want to do is recreate that as best we can with how film has influenced Star Trek. It was a fun panel that we did, and we got a lot of great response from audience members, and people actually seemed interested in hearing it.
Yeah, people asked us if there would be a recorded version so they could write down some of the movies we talked about and things like that, and also just for our general listeners who weren't in Las Vegas.
Yeah, exactly.
So
we've got, and I think the format of this will be a little bit more rigid than we typically have the podcast, and so it'll sound a little different compared with what our usual regular listeners typically hear, but I don't know, I think it'll be interesting and informative nonetheless.
And we'll try to sort of incorporate a little more of the Subspace personality, just in case, you know, you were there and you're like, am I going to listen to the exact same conversation?
My answer is yes.
It'll be 90%, maybe 75%, but we're going to try to maybe include a few little tidbits here and there.
I'm going for 96%.
96? Okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm already down to 96% because I think we can throw away my introduction to Subspace Transmissions for all those people that are not familiar with Subspace Transmissions.
For sure. I think that's good to go.
Okay, so Cam, why don't you take it away there?
Right. Well, I mean, we've talked so much about Star Trek in the past, obviously, but this is really about examining how film has influenced Star Trek. Now, Star Trek sort of belongs to this weirdo subgenre called space westerns. It's sort of a mashup of like early science fiction pulp, like the old Flash Gordon serials, that sort of thing, with the cowboy culture of like John Ford westerns. Now, John Ford, probably the most influential western director, other than maybe like Sergio Leone, he cranked out countless westerns, countless films, period. But he was a director who would often say, "My name is John Ford and I make westerns." Like, that was what he really specialized in. And some of the themes that he tackled in these movies, very applicable to Star Trek. You can see it time and time again. Some of those themes are the idea of, like, community and integration. I mean, how much is this like Star Trek? Just the idea of, you know, communities coming together of different types of people. I mean, we see it time and time again.
Absolutely. One of the hallmarks, I would say, of Star Trek, Cam.
Infinite diversity and infinite combinations.
Live long and prosper. That's what they said in all those John Ford westerns, right?
That's right. That's right. Yes. There's also just the idea of nostalgia for the frontier, because, Tyler, we're of the generation, perhaps the troubled generation, that we get angry about like 80s movies being remade.
Oh, yeah. You should have seen me on the YouTube comments section for that Ghostbusters trailer. I was a wild man.
You were Ghost Hater 89?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, I actually liked Ghostbusters. I thought it was fine.
It was fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, back in sort of John Ford's era, a lot of these people had... YouTube didn't exist. And a lot of people at that period of time were very nostalgic for, you know, their ancestors who had conquered the frontier, had been pioneers. And so they're in this point in time where it's like, boy, my ancestors like settled this whole country that I'm living in. And you know, there's other issues to do with that. But, but you know, it's just the idea of they had accomplished so much. How can we ever live up to it? Sort of like how the children of the baby boomers felt. That's how John Ford's generation felt. So they were very nostalgic about the frontier. You see that in Star Trek, the idea of untapped wilderness for Kirk and Picard, etc., to explore. There's also the idea of outsiders being like men of action as well as thinkers. You see this like in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. The idea of, you know, men who maybe come from out of town and come in and have to solve problems, whether through their fists or guns or just with their minds. I mean, how many times does Kirk or Janeway or Archer, you know, land on a planet and have to solve a problem for the planet.
Well, I can tell you how many times an alien lands a punch on Archer's face. Almost every episode, Cam.
Exactly, Tyler.
Yes.
So, you know, these themes really carry. And, of course, the other big theme of John Ford Westerns is Abraham Lincoln. But I don't think that ever paid off in Star Trek, did it?
I think there's at least 5 instances I can think of.
Really? I can't think of a single shining one.
Well, you know what? You haven't been paying attention, Cameron.
I guess so.
So I think one of the movies that we want to tackle when it comes to the influence that film has had on Star Trek is an early one from the 1950s, Forbidden Planets. Now, this follows the adventures of one Commander Adams and his triumvirate that they land on an alien planet, a strange new world, if you will. It includes one Doc Ostro, Lieutenant Farman, that's part of this crew under the command of one Commander Adams, played by Leslie Nielsen. Cam, this is one of the highest budgeted sci-fi films, if not the highest budgeted sci-fi films at the time.
Yeah.
Very influential when it comes to the visual look of Star Trek. Just look at, say, the stasis pods they have on board the ship in Forbidden Planet versus the look of the transporter pads on Star Trek. It's very, very similar. So you can see that there's this visual influence that we're getting from a film such as Forbidden Planets.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, though, Gene Roddenberry vehemently denied that this had any sort of influence on Star Trek. He actually went so far as to say that, I've seen Forbidden Planet before. The only thing that I really got out of it was, like, there's a number of mistakes in it that I wanted to avoid in Star Trek. However, somebody actually unearthed some production notes from Gene Roddenberry. Yeah, he was actually requesting, like, some still images from the movie that his production workers could, like, zoom in on and kind of get some sort of visual inspiration for, like, the look of the film. So that movie absolutely had a huge influence on Star Trek. The other thing that we should mention here is Forbidden Planet, it's a very overt interpretation of Shakespeare's The Tempest.
But, I mean, Shakespeare's not a big thing in Star Trek.
No, nobody ever talks about Shakespeare in Star Trek. Yeah. So I don't even know why I brought that up just now.
Yeah, why are you wasting the listeners' time?
Yeah. But for listeners, if you get a chance, it is quite striking if you go ahead and watch Forbidden Planet. Just see a lot of the similarities. I mentioned, like, the triumvirate, but it's more so than that, just kind of the visual look of the movie as well. And
yeah.
Look, of course, Star Trek, we always have kind of the wacky scientist and the young temptress, you know, there. And this continues on throughout Star Trek and Forbidden Planet as well.
If you watch the episode Requiem for Methuselah, that episode is really interesting in how close it is to Forbidden Planet. In that one, you know, Kirk encounters this sort of being who's been around a long time, very wise, basically like the scientist in Forbidden Planet. And he has a female assistant who is a robot. So you kind of have Robbie the robot and the female lead of Forbidden Planet kind of combined into one character. Again, you watch that and compare it to Forbidden Planet, so close. But, you know, the influence of Forbidden Planet goes right across Star Trek. I was actually just watching a bonus feature on one of the Voyager DVDs, and it was in regards to the episode Workforce. There is a shot where, you know, the crew are getting on that elevator, that long elevator that heads down into the factory where they all work. And the special effects guy is just saying, that's my Forbidden Planet shot.
Okay.
That's taken from the moment they're going down the elevator. So even, you know, the technical crew, you know, back in, like, what, the year 19, in the late 90s, essentially, is saying Forbidden Planet is still inspiring our, you know, Star Trek episodes.
Yeah, like, I know it's an older movie, but it's something to look at. It really is something to behold just visually. Like, it's something I still truly admire to this day.
It still holds up. Like, a movie like Earth versus the Flying Saucers, maybe not so much nowadays, but Forbidden Planet really has aged incredibly well.
Cam, are there any other films that had, like, a very notable influence on just, you know, those first formative years of Star Trek?
Yeah, I mean, Gene Roddenberry denied Forbidden Planet's influence. He did not deny the influence of Robinson Crusoe on Mars. This is a 1964 movie, not as famous as Forbidden Planet, but really, really good. It was directed by Byron Haskin, who actually produced The Cage. Roddenberry was actually very interested in him after seeing this movie and thought maybe he could produce Star Trek. He produced The Cage, and then that was about it. But it just didn't get along with Roddenberry. But, I mean, Roddenberry loved this movie. He went to the Desilu exec, Oscar Katz, and was like, look, you've got to see this movie, and I want the department heads to see this movie because it has like a really grounded, believable pseudoscience, which Star Trek does too. You know, it's not played campy like older movies, like turn on the, you know, ray guns and things like that. Like, it's not played kind of as like kind of silly for the kids. It's very grounded.
I like Ghostbusters. I don't know what you're talking about, Cam.
It also just has beautiful, beautiful art direction. You look at the caves, they don't just look like gray rock or like that chintzy kind of paper mache stuff you would see in older sci-fi. It's like beautiful, like purple and gray and, you know, green mixtures sort of into the rock. It looks a lot like when you watch like What Little Girls Are Made Of, you know, an episode like that, or Devil in the Dark, where this episode could look really grungy and crappy, kind of like some of the TNG cave scenes later down the road, but in TOS they look beautiful, like Robinson Crusoe on Mars.
I don't get that deal. Like, why go from like those beautiful kind of like very popping colors that you have in the original series, which obviously came from big influence on film, and then you go to like kind of like that... What was the 80s all about, Cam? What was it about, like, just the dreariest colors, save for neon, that you could find?
It's weird, because the 80s was, like, the age of excess.
Yeah.
So you'd think they would kind of want big, almost Baz Luhrmann-like visuals in their movies. Not the case. No. It was more about, like...
Muted colors.
It was more about the movies having, like, more explicit violence.
Yeah.
And more, like, nudity and sexual content. It wasn't so much about, like, visually dynamic filmmaking. Really strange.
Well, we did find out at least one character was anatomically correct, so
very
maybe that came from the 80s.
Very true. But another similarity with the art direction of Robinson Crusoe on Mars is the sky. It's these flat technicolor skies, very vibrant colors, that are a lot like the original series. You know, the Vulcan sky in A Mock Time or the Apple, you know, it looks a lot like the sky of Mars in Robinson Crusoe. There's also just the idea of sort of taming the wild frontier. Again, we get to see the Robinson Crusoe character in this movie do that. And it's kind of romanticized about him. He's not like in, you know, Tom Hanks in Castaway, like chipping out his teeth. He's very much like building a new world, yeah. Which is very Star Trek, sort of has that optimism. There's also, interestingly, a lot of shots of the ship flying from sort of the upper left corner of the screen to the lower right. That's how they keep communicating that the ship is sailing around orbit around this planet. Very much like the Enterprise that started the TOS credits, you know, which would be carried through all the other shows. And there's a few little interesting connections going on, because Victor Ludlin, who plays sort of the Man Friday in Robinson Crusoe on Mars, ultimately was the first Klingon ever in Star Trek to appear. He played the Klingon lieutenant in Errand of Mercy.
Do you think that was just sheer coincidence, or maybe something intentional on the part of the producers?
It's tough to say. He would have been... He's a very distinctive-looking actor.
Yeah.
So I think he would have fit very well if you're casting like someone to play an alien on TV. But he also had genre experience, so it's quite possible that that kind of carried him over. Although he didn't get the lead, unfortunately. But what could have been.
Yeah.
Albert Whitlock, who did the matte paintings for Robinson Crusoe, would work on Star Trek. He did most notably like The Menagerie. And then the composer, Nathan Van Cleve, was very much considered to score Star Trek. But, you know, ultimately didn't quite work out. You know, we wound up with some guy named Alexander Courage. How did that turn out? I don't know.
You know what? I've been known to maybe hum the tune once or twice.
Yeah. Okay. It's a little memorable.
A little memorable. You know, I do wonder if we'll ever hear it again.
Who knows? Yeah.
Well, you know, you bring up Taming the Wild Frontier a little bit earlier on, Cam. You also brought up space westerns. What about just, like, westerns in general, though? I mean, of course, Gene Roddenberry, it's well known that he pitched this as Wagon Train to the Stars. And Gene Roddenberry, he cut his teeth writing a lot of these westerns for network television back in the day. And honestly, to me, yeah, Star Trek, Final Frontier, that influence is very obvious. But that carries through a lot of the later series as well.
Yeah.
I think Deep Space Nine, probably the most notable example there. You're literally... a frontier town on the edge of kind of like known civilization.
Mm-hmm.
You have everything from like a duplicitous barkeep known as Quark to perhaps a sheriff known as Constable Odo. You know, and look, you're at the mouth of a wormhole where all kinds of unknown civilizations are right at your doorstep. So to me, it's interesting that, you know, nearly 30 years after Star Trek premiered, we're getting that influence throughout the rest of the series. So why don't we just tackle some of the movies that had a big influence on the Western aspects of Star Trek. Of course, right. There's Fistful of Data. That's one of your all-time favorite episodes.
I think that's well documented on this podcast.
Yeah, and of course, that had a big influence from Rio Bravo, very much kind of the same father-son dynamic going on there.
As well as, like, Fistful of Dollars for the title. But it's not really the Fistful of Dollars story.
Not the story, but hey, you know what? I think the original title for that episode is going to be The Good, the Bad, and the Klingon. So they wanted to have kind of like a funny episode title.
Which do you prefer?
I kind of like The Good, the Bad, and the Klingon myself.
I kind of do too.
Yeah.
It's distinctive. I don't know.
Hey, so is Fistful of Datas.
That's true.
Another episode, Sons and Daughters, Rio Grande. That's also kind of that father-son dynamic we get with Alexander and Worf once again.
The Kid in Rio Grande, which is the third, I believe, of John Ford's Cavalry trilogy. With She Wore a Yellow Ribbon and Ford Apache. It's the least of the three, but it's really interesting how those two stories mesh up. Although I'll say the kid in Rio Grande is not as much of a wiener as little Alexander.
Alexander turned into the albatross of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Back when albatross was a good luck symbol for a ship.
You know? Right.
So there you go. North Star, that's taking more of an influence from kind of the modern day Western, such as Unforgiven.
Mostly with the hat.
Pretty much, I'd say so. Yeah. Not my favorite episode of Enterprise, but...
What?
Them's the breaks. and then another Enterprise episode, I think a bit of a stronger entry, though, is Marauders. That's definitely much more of a Magnificent Seven homage than I think maybe kind of the more obvious one. A lot of people maybe associate that with Magnificent Ferengi, but Cam, really beyond the title and the very basic concept, was Magnificent Ferengi really a retelling of the Magnificent Seven?
Not really. No. Just really, really loosely in terms of the premise.
Like, recruit some misfits.
But that, yeah, exactly. But it could also be Dirty Dozen or what have you. It doesn't feel like it's very, like, Western influenced.
We should have called it the Dirty Ferengi.
If you're going to make a Western influenced DS9 episode with the Ferengi, you don't have Iggy Pop in it.
No, that was a pretty badass moment.
It was, but he doesn't have that sort of that pioneering sort of look to him.
Well, Cam, there's one last episode that maybe you can expand on, because I think another Deep Space Nine episode, Indiscretion, what about the influence that we're seeing from The Searchers, another John Ford film?
Yeah, I mean, John Ford is all over Star Trek. And Indiscretion, this is the episode where Kira and Dukat go in search of his lover, who was on aboard a Cardassian ship that was carrying Bajoran slaves that disappeared for a long period of time. Ultimately, it's found crash-landed on this sort of deserty planet, and the two of them go down. Kira thinks it's a bit of a rescue mission to find this woman, even though the odds of anyone being alive on the ship are pretty much slim to none.
You gotta have hope and optimism in the world of Star Trek, Cam.
Exactly. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that's not the case. You know, the ship has crashed, but it turns out that Dukat had a daughter who has been kidnapped by the Breen and is now held captive as a slave, and turns out he wants to kill her.
Mm.
Now, if this all sounds a little familiar, it's because it's pretty much taken part and parcel from the 1956 John Ford Western, The Searchers. Probably the most famous Western of the, at least in terms of reputation at this point. It's very much held up as John Ford's, one of his top, if not the top, Western he made. That movie stars John Wayne as a sort of disgraced Civil War soldier who goes in search of his niece who has been stolen by Comanches. And the journey kind of takes him across years. The DS9 one's much more compressed time period. But in that, you know, at first we think John Wayne is going to save his niece, but it turns out that he wants to kill her. And the voice of conscience is his half-Comanche sidekick, played by Jeffrey Hunter. And Jeffrey Hunter, obvious Star Trek connection, thanks to The Cage. Kira is very much the Jeffrey Hunter character. And there are...
That's why she has that little scooter that she drives around and pushing buttons that mean yes or no, right?
Right, exactly. Okay. And so you get Kira in this role. I mean, this is a Dukat episode. He is the lead of this episode, which is really fascinating. I love how DS9 did that with supporting characters. But you can see so much of the Ethan Dukat comparisons. Both characters are incredibly racist and there's a lot of discussion in the episode about, you know, Dukat's hatred of the Bajorans and just how twisted he is in his perception of them. And yet he seems to understand an awful lot about them. You know, there's a scene where they're talking about the burial rites when they're looking at the graves around the ship. And Dukat knows an awful lot and seems weirdly respectful of Bajoran burial rites, kind of like John Wayne is when he finds a Comanche burial ground. And now he uses that in a very dark, in a much darker way. He shoots the Comanche's eyes out, because that way he'll be, according to their understanding of the afterlife, stuck on Earth forever and unable to join sort of the great beyond. Dukat doesn't do anything that grim. Oh, but it is a very similar scene, as well as when they find the ship. It has, like, you know, they're looking at all these laser bolts on it, or phaser shots and everything, and kind of saying what's happened to it. Very much like the burning homestead at the start of The Searchers. Again, Torziel, who's this great source of shame to Dukat. Again, like the niece in The Searchers, who's been, you know, in the eyes of Ethan, corrupted by the Comanche. He feels that he has to kill her because she is now a disgrace to the family. And it all, you know, comes to a big dramatic scene where Dukat and Ethan have their guns pointed at these women. And, you know, Jeffrey Hunter slash Kira are trying to talk them down. And ultimately, both men put down their guns and, you know, use a variation on the line, "Let's go home." And both Indiscretion is a great episode, and The Searchers is a masterpiece. So you can't do wrong sometimes homaging the best. And I think this is a great example of that.
I'm behind it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, following the Westerns, you know, war movies might not seem like the most obvious influence on Star Trek.
Yeah, I think Star Trek's mostly known for, like I said before, hope and optimism.
Right. Well, but, you know,
you got to shoot people up sometimes. Is that it?
Right. Sometimes, I guess. But the thing about World War II movies was World War II was the first war that happened during Hollywood's golden age. You had movies about World War I, like All Quiet on the Western Front, which won Best Picture in like 1930. Great film, but World War II happened right at sort of prime Hollywood time, and Hollywood really got behind it. And they used the movies as a means of propaganda, obviously, but also as a way of really lifting the spirits of everyone at home and using their resources to communicate to the people at home who are sending their kids off to war that they were heroes and that they mattered. And, you know, a lot of that sort of, that optimistic look at heroes going to war is something that does kind of pop up in Star Trek. And, you know, it would be later on that World War II movies would be a little more maybe pessimistic or realistic and talk about the effects it had on soldiers. But you can see some examples. You know, Bridge on the River Kwai, David Lean's epic, is referenced by both the Hippocratic Oath, the episode where Bashir encounters the sort of the group of Jem'Hadar. And who are sort of in this safe prison, essentially. And that's a theme that we would also see again in Birthright Part 2, an episode we reviewed fairly recently on the podcast.
Some of the best spear-on-hoop action I've ever seen in Star Trek before.
Right, and in that episode, Worf is held in like a Romulan prison that's very friendly. They're like, no, they're prisoners, but they're not really prisoners. Again, like,
how could you be a prisoner if you've got that much spear-on-hoop action
exactly
in one spot camp?
Exactly. Very Bridge on the River Kwai. As well, Balance of Terror, the famous original series episode with Kirk trying to match wits with the Romulan commander. Very, very similar to The Enemy Below. It was inspired by The Enemy Below, and as well as Run Silent and Run Deep, two World War II submarine pictures. Both very, very good. Now, Tyler, I think you had one movie you wanted to talk a little bit about.
Well, yeah. If you go look at yesterday's Enterprise, you know, one of the all-time great episodes is Next Generation. Listen to an interview from Iris Stephen Bear, who's talking on the Blu-ray / DVD special features. He really took the climax of that film in which Picard jumps behind the tactical console and starts firing on the Klingons. He took that from the film Bataan, which featured the sergeant firing a spray of machine gun bullets at the enemies that were attacking them. Well, Iris Stephen Bear even admitted that Picard mashing his hands on these buttons didn't quite have the same effect, but that's what he was going for. I think it was a noble failure in that part.
You can only do so much with the resources you have.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked a lot in the past about how Star Trek action rarely measures up.
I'm hoping Star Trek Discovery, it's been 50 years. I think we can get to the point where we can get some good action scenes in television nowadays.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, I can think of a trio of episodes of Star Trek that are very much inspired by a war film. Think about the episode Dawn, where Trip and the Arconian crash land on the planet, that sort of burning, scorching planet, and have to work together against, you know, their initial prejudice against one another. Think about the episode The Enemy, with Geordi having to kind of befriend a Romulan on this really barren, rocky planet. Again, the rocks don't look quite as good as they did back in the old days of TOS in this one. And then also Darmok, the famous Darmok, where Captain Picard and Captain Dathon are stranded on this planet with an invisible creature. Captain Picard can't understand Captain Dathon, who speaks in metaphors, and it's about these two men kind of having to understand each other. Now, when you look at those three episodes compared kind of together, they may seem a little reminiscent of a 1985 science fiction movie called Enemy Mine, which was directed by Wolfgang Peterson. It starred Dennis Quaid and Lou Gossett Jr., and it was about this sort of this hard-bitten Han Solo type who crash lands on a planet with an alien, and they sort of learn to understand one another. There's a birth at one point. It's a really good movie with a really lousy ending. But ultimately, Enemy Mine was inspired by a really, really good 1968 war film directed by John Boorman. Now, John Boorman is a really interesting director, loved to tackle masculinity, especially in his early movies. He directed Deliverance, Excalibur, Point Blank, which is the Lee Marvin noir that was later remade as Payback with Mel Gibson, as well as Parker with Jason Statham. It was a real sliding slope there.
Yeah.
But in 1968...
Did you actually see Payback?
I saw all of them.
I remember paying money for that. And I went in this, like, pay me back box office.
I never watched the director's cut, which hit DVD a few years ago. But
I can't wait to watch that one.
Prepare for a whole other episode on that.
Yeah.
But yeah, in 1968, John Boorman directed a movie called Hell in the Pacific, which inspired Enemy Mine. And it's a movie about an American and a Japanese soldier, played by Lee Marvin and Toshiro Mifune, who are stranded and have to kind of work together. Because initially, you know, there's a lot of misunderstandings because they can't understand each other. They can't understand each other's language. So they immediately expect hostility from one another. There's a lot of trying to battling over resources, trying to steal each other's water. And, you know, which section of the beach each other one has. It's a really entertaining movie to watch these two men grapple and assume the worst of one another because of the wartime. Now, 1968, when this comes out, Vietnam War. You know, this is right when America's getting pessimistic about the Vietnam War, and that carries over into Hell in the Pacific. So while Hell in the Pacific is a World War II movie, it's a Vietnam movie.
Yeah.
About sort of the futility of war, because...
And I think the applicability of certain stories is something... is very much a hallmark of Star Trek. So that's why I think it's important that we do bring up these war films, is because they are... the thing to understand, a lot of these war films during that era, they're actually anti-war films.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Hell in the Pacific is very much about how these two men need to put aside their conflicts and their, you know, what their countries want them to do, and realize that they both are, you know, good men with things to offer. And ultimately, it's about their friendship and respect for one another that ultimately is cut short by war. So it's a very pessimistic movie, a very, you know, hard-bitten, kind of mean movie, but it's a really good one. And you can see why the themes of Hell in the Pacific, you know, inspired Enemy Mine, which were, of course, carried on to three really great Star Trek episodes. And who knows, we may get this premise, it's sure an elastic premise, in Star Trek Discovery, who knows?
Can't wait to find out. Well, you know, I keep coming back to this same... keyword here, Cam, optimism. Star Trek, it's what it's all about.
Sure.
It's like the Hokey Pokey.
Right.
But noir, that's not something you generally associate with optimism, and for good reason. This genre of film, it really started to take shape in the late 1940s. It's kind of the post-war era. It was shaped very much by a sense of pessimism, corrupt systems, these anti-heroes, these femme fatales. It's not really what Star Trek's known all about, but a lot of these very, very influential movies had a big part to play with a lot of the episodes and the stories that we see all over Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Let's start with this, Casablanca. Great classic film, turned into one of the great classic episodes of early Next Generation. We'll always have Paris.
Yeah, as well as, you know, Quark in DS9.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who is the Sam in that situation there?
I guess it's Rom.
Rom's the Sam?
I guess so.
Play it again, Rom.
Sure.
Okay. No, spin it again, Lita. There you go. And I think another notable one, these hard-boiled crime movies, a lot of them being adapted from Raymond Chandler novels. But of course, let's talk about Dixon Hill, The Big Goodbye, very much kind of the big influence from Maltese Falcon as well. How many versions of that film have you actually seen? Have you seen...
Just the one, Humphrey Bogart.
I've seen just the one, but aren't there like three versions?
Yeah, there's been quite a few.
I think the first one didn't get great reviews, did it?
No.
Yeah, that's kind of why I've skipped it.
Yeah.
But, can't wait till they remake that once again. I'm sure it'll be gold.
Like Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
So one of the ones that I do want to zero in on a little bit more, though, is an episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation, The Mind's Eye. This is where Geordi LaForge is kidnapped and brainwashed by Romulan agents, and he's programmed to assassinate this Klingon politician. This sounds familiar. It's very, very similar to the plot of The Manchurian Candidates. That's actually one of my all-time favorite movies. Mm-hmm. There, directed by one Jan Frankenheimer.
Mm-hmm.
Great director there. He was making movies well into his 80s.
Reindeer Games was, you know, he was really old when he made that.
One of your favorites.
Obviously.
Yes.
Yeah, but he did make Ronin again when he was old. That was sort of his last great movie.
Yeah. Great car chase scene. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they can carry that kind of great action into Star Trek Discovery.
We can only hope.
Can't wait for the great car chase scene through the tunnels of Paris in Star Trek Discovery. But here's the thing. This episode was actually directed by one David Livingston. He was a first-time director for Star Trek, but he was a long-time producer on Next Generation. He said that he could not have wished for a better episode to direct because he was a huge Manchurian Candidate fan. So he had like certain homages that he wanted to do. He used a lot of, say, wide-angle lenses. I think it's most pronounced when Geordi's leaving Turbolift, walking down a corridor. He also, a very overt homage to a very iconic scene in Madison Square Garden where the assassin is looking down upon the crowds there from his kind of crow's nest perch through the scope of a rifle. Well, with Next Generation, there's a little bit limited by sets, so we do have a very high angle shot of the cargo bay looking down upon the assassination target there.
Right.
So, guys, if you haven't seen The Manchurian Candidate yet, I would definitely recommend that you watch, I would say, watch that one first and then follow up with The Mind's Eye, and you'll just be kind of blown away by all the similarities between the two.
Yeah, it's too bad there was no shot of, like, them shooting, like, a phaser through a carton of milk.
Okay, that would have been pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, why not include a game of poker in that episode, too, to, you know, have, was it the Queen of Hearts, I think, was the big card being played? Guys, watch the movie. You'll get all this brainwash programming illusions that we're making.
The thing about that episode, too, is, like, the homage is very overt. Kind of like Indiscretion with the Searchers. So it's not one where you even have to kind of really dive deep into it to try and find these parallels. They're there, right on the surface. Another movie that really has them on the surface is the movie Narrow Margin. Now, tell me if this story sounds familiar. A gruff lawman who's sort of trapped in a confined space with a mystery woman who's carrying crucial evidence that could take down a criminal figure, and they're trailed by two goons. And they kind of have to deceive these goons by, you know, moving from room to room, and ultimately have to outsmart them using sort of this ingenuity and, you know, sort of this moment of desperation. Now, this is the story of Narrow Margin, the 1952 Richard Fleischer film noir, where a lawman played by Charles McGraw has to help this mob mistress escape from two goons aboard a train. It's also the story of the DS9 episode, A Simple Investigation. This is the episode where Odo, this is shortly after he's been turned into a solid, he's very ill at ease in his own skin, doesn't know how to relate to the crew in his current form, and he meets this woman, this mystery woman named Arissa, who seems to be an Orion Syndicate member who's escaped her, you know, former lover, and is carrying this data crystal, but is actually an Idanian undercover agent. And, there's a love story, and ultimately they're trailed by these two alien goons who don't have as big a role as they do in Narrow Margin. They spend a lot of time just, like, sitting in what looks like a back hallway.
Yeah.
But there's scenes where, like, Odo and this woman are, like, beaming from room to room to kind of throw them off the scent. And, again, it comes down to this big twist of, who this woman actually is. And both A Simple Investigation and Narrow Margin are redemption stories about these men. You know, it's about Odo getting a little bit of comfort in his new form. And Charles McGraw is sort of this hard-bitten cop whose partner's been killed, doesn't care about anything, man. You know, he chews nails and spits out tacks sort of guy. And
that's how I met you for the first time. You're very intimidating.
Exactly. And, you know, that's about him finding happiness. The movie Narrow Margin's a little more optimistic than the Star Trek episode, but again, the redemption theme is there. Now, if you're thinking, you know, well, hey, I've just heard them talk about Narrow Margin. I've seen A Simple Investigation. What's the point watching that movie? Well, Narrow Margin has two women and two twists. So there's plenty of surprises left in that movie. So it is totally worth checking out. Really, really good. And it inspired a really good episode of DS9.
Absolutely.
So let's move into classic science fiction, because while, you know, war and noir films may seem like a stretch with Star Trek, classic sci-fi, not so much.
No, not at all.
You know, classic sci-fi really was born again in the 1950s after the atomic bomb, and there's this renewed interest in what science could accomplish and what horrors it could unleash. There's also so much paranoia because of the Cold War and the burgeoning concern about communists. And so science fiction of that era really took this form of these movies that were cautionary tales about, you know, watching your neighbor or just fear of, you know, what's going on in your community around you. And so, you know, the first of the sort of this new wave of science fiction movies came in 1950. It was called Destination Moon. It's interesting for historical reasons, but it's not a movie that's held as a great, you know, classic of the era. But in 1951, you got the 1-2 punch of The Day the Earth Stood Still and The Thing from Another World, the Howard Hawks version, which was later remade as John Carpenter's The Thing in 82. These two were huge, huge hits that were very popular and hugely influential on all the sci-fi going forward. They really touched on these themes of anxiety and paranoia. And you can see sort of the impact of The Thing from Another World and the 82 thing on, like, the DS9 episode The Adversary, where there's a changeling on board the Defiant, and they're not sure who it could be. There's, again, they're, you know, don't know who to trust of their friends, and they're doing, like, tests to see who it could be. Again, that's from the John Carpenter movie. As well as another movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers. We see that show up a couple times in TNG in particular, in the episode The Game, which of course has the great Ryza game that Crusher brings back to the, or that Riker brings back to the ship.
Like, it'd be amazing if Crusher brought it back, but it was Wesley Crusher that ended up saving the day.
Of course.
One of my favorite moments. I actually think that he earned this one.
Right. Okay. Yeah, it's a good, it's probably, might be the best Wesley episode, or one of the best.
But I think another one that had that Body Snatchers influence, though, Cam, was Conspiracy, season 1, TNG. Yeah. Which, of course, those worm aliens are infiltrating Starfleet and making high-ranking officers doing things against their will. Very much kind of that on-the-nose, you know, motif, so to speak, to Invasion.
That's a really fun episode, but very un-Star Trek-y.
Yeah, just the kind of the grotesqueness of it isn't something I typically associate with Star Trek.
But
there you go.
It's fun, though. Yeah. I do enjoy that one. And, you know, another movie, huge classic, Planet of the Apes, seems to have at least colored in some of the shading of the episode Distant Origin, the Voyager episode with the dinosaurs. This one's kind of a curiosity, because to watch it, it's very reminiscent of Planet of the Apes. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, but the thing is, I think when we're talking about kind of the influence of film on Star Trek, they don't have to be all these overt homages, even ones that are conscious. A lot of this could just be maybe a costume designer, a makeup designer, adding a certain touch that they're not even aware of. And it's clear if you go through collective consciousness, you know, it's stemming from some of these very influential films throughout, you know, the ages.
Right, exactly, because film and TV is so collaborative that you don't know what's in the minds of everyone who's pitching ideas, you know, for, hey, I'm going to set up this shot. But in their head, they're thinking, I'm going to take this shot from this movie that I love, or, you know, that inspired me to go into what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But maybe they're not communicating that to the director, saying, hey, this is my shot from Planet of the Apes. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about the DS9 episode One Little Ship. This is a really fun episode. We haven't really talked about much on the podcast, I don't think.
Well, we could save it for maybe a hidden gem episode or something.
Sure,
like that.
Part 4. This is the episode where the Rubicon containing Bashir, O'Brien, and Dax get shrunk down, and they've got to save the Defiant from this invasion of Jem'Hadar. Now, this is an episode that is very much inspired by classic sci-fi. Ira Stephen Bear had this to say about the episode. It was something that was pitched a lot, beginning with in TNG, and just kept getting shot down over and over into, you know, until season 6 of DS9, when finally Iris Stephen Bear had this to say about it. He said, "We had to do it. We owed it to all the schlock sci-fi that had come before us. If we hadn't done it, it would have been a crime, a creative crime, and, dare I say, a crime against humanity itself."
he did dare to say that. I can't believe he went there.
Not remotely hyperbolic there. but you can very much see the influence of two movies on One Little Ship in particular. The first movie was 1957's The Incredible Shrinking Man. It was directed by Jack Arnold. He directed one of my favorite of the Universal Horror movies with Creature from the Black Lagoon. Really interesting.
I thought your favorite was The Blue Lagoon starring Brooke Shields.
That was equally horrific.
Okay.
An absolute masterpiece of a science fiction film.
I agree. Brooke Shields, stunning.
It's about a guy who's contaminated by a mix of mist that's infused with radiation as well as pesticides, two very big concerns in the 1950s, and gradually shrinks down until he's essentially the size of an atom and smaller. But along the way, he has to battle like cats and spiders. And it's a very much like One Little Ship. It's this idea of, it's not a sort of a linear story of, an arc. It's about moment-to-moment crises. Having to deal with each phase of this situation. In One Little Ship, they're going down plasma vents and they've got to outrun, fire. They have to get aboard, then they have to dodge Jem'Hadar. They have to take control back of the Defiant. It's, again, overcoming these obstacles one by one. And that's very much the way Invisible Man is. It's like a survival, almost horror movie. But it really ends on this note of optimism that's very Star Trek-y. I have to believe this might have been a studio note, because I just don't think at the time they were like, we got to make this a really grim, dark movie.
Yeah.
But it's really beautiful, because he gets down to this, beyond an atom small, and realizes that he is going to explore things that no man has ever explored before, and that he is important because of that. He matters. The other movie that very much inspired One Little Ship is Fantastic Voyage. This is the more obvious one, from 1966. Also directed by Fleischer, who did Narrow Margin. Fleischer did a lot of good movies. He did Soylent Green, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the not-so-good Conan the Destroyer. But
it's still a little surprising he's not better known.
Yeah, no. Just one of those guys like Michael Curtiz, who directed a lot of great movies that people still remember, but they don't know his name. It doesn't roll off the tongue Hitchcock or whatever of the era. But Fantastic Voyage, it's a well-known movie. It's about the submarine Proteus, which is staffed by Raquel Welch, Donald Pleasence, shrunk down, injected into the bloodstream of this scientist who's had a brain clot, and they've got to travel up his anatomy and fix this brain clot because he has information that will aid in the American efforts during the Cold War. And again, this is sort of taking the idea of exploring a new world just inside the human body, which turns out to be surprisingly hallucinogenic looking. Interesting Star Trek connection, Leonard Rosenman scored this film, and he would go on to score Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. And
my favorite score of all Star Trek films, right, Cam?
Of course.
I'm on the record saying that. And for all you who doubt me, just go back and re-listen to our review of Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
And the hospital chase scene.
Oh, dear Lord. Don't remind me.
Yeah, so let's move into blockbusters, because blockbusters are what we know now, because we get blockbusters every week.
It's true.
Blockbusters really started in 1975. You had Jaws come out and make $100 million. It was released in the summer, and it was a big deal, and studios had never seen that before. Summer was traditionally a dumping ground, and suddenly here was a movie that made more money than any movie had ever made before, and they thought, maybe this is an anomaly? 1977 Star Wars hits, changes everything.
Yeah.
And so between these two young upstarts, Spielberg and George Lucas, boom, we're living through it now. Big time.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, so
I can thank you guys for Suicide Squad.
Blockbusters are hugely influential on Star Trek. You can see.
Yeah, I can see that in Suicide Squad. I can't wait for Brian Fuller to get all that influence into Star Trek Discovery.
We can only hope.
Yeah.
Damaged. A few examples. The Indiana Jones series, you can see a lot of that. We talked about it with the Gambit two-parter from TNG, as well as actually the DS9 episode Sword of Kalos, where Jadzian, the crew of classic TOS Klingons, go searching for the mythical Sword of Kalos, which, true to Indiana Jones fashion, they don't get. Winds up lost in space, never to be, held by any man or woman.
I'm okay with that.
Sure. You've also got, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. There's a scene where Richard Dreyfuss is building the Mashed Potato Mountain, very much like Avery Brooks' Sisko building the Vegetable Temple in Rapture.
Maybe not quite the same effect, but
equally iconic, Tyler.
Okay,
equally iconic.
Okay.
Interesting one, Lethal Weapon. Martin Riggs was the inspiration for older Harry Kim in the episode Timeless.
How so?
Garrett Wong was having sort of issues kind of getting to the mindset of this older version of Kim, and Braga told him, you know, think of Martin Riggs. I can't say that I see it, but hey, it's there.
If it gave Garrett Wong inspiration, then I say, yeah, it's legit.
Yeah. And Star Wars, well, that could be a whole another episode unto itself of Star Wars influences through Star Trek, but there's a few we can think of right off the bat.
Maybe we'll do it next year in Las Vegas.
Maybe. You know, you have like the Breen armor, which, as I've said many times on this podcast, you know, very like a bounty hunter Leia from Return of the Jedi.
Oh, yeah.
You even have Kira dressing up in that armor in Indiscretion. You have the Zindi weapon, which looks a lot like the Death Star, serves a similar purpose, as well as the Sulaban hologram that I've come to refer to as just Darth Sidious.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah, lots
Don't
of that.
Don't remind me.
And then Starship Mine is an interesting one. It's Blockbuster connection with Die Hard.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, Cam. We were talking about this not too long ago, and it appears the writer of Starship Mine denied that there's anything involved with Die Hard. But, I mean, look, we've got, like, these terrorists taking over a tower. We've got these hijackers taking over a deserted Enterprise. There has to be a connection there, right?
Yeah.
Why is the writer going so far as to say no?
I think he's just bitter because they had to cut the line, yippee-ki-yay, mother crusher.
Okay. It makes sense now.
Yeah, so I think you had one you want to talk about, right?
Yeah, one of my favorite episodes ever, Threshold.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you know, listeners. Cam and I, we've actually rewatched that episode more times than I'd ever expect to do since I first started watching Voyager back in the 90s. It's an interesting one. It's not well regarded, but Cam, you would agree, it's still an entertaining film.
Oh, yeah.
Or entertaining episode, and I think it took a lot of influence from films. This, of course, is the one where Tom Paris reaches warp 10 and starts turning into a salamander. So just look at the influence there from David Cronenberg's The Fly, where the scientist has this transformation after a lab experiment gone wrong. Much like Tom Paris, Jeff Goldblum's character starts losing limbs, you know, appendages from his body. Paris most notably loses his tongue mm-hmm. in this one. A very iconic scene there. It also has a lot of influence from, I would say, 2001, A Space Odyssey, when you have that cosmic journey that turns into a transformation with, of course, the Star Child at the very end of 2001. Here we get salamander babies from Paris and Janeway.
That would be amazing if the final shot was just like one of them inside, like, floating in space.
We'll save that for Threshold Part 2. Can't wait, Brian Fuller. We're giving you gold right here. We're pitching you all the stuff every fan wants to see for Star Trek Discovery. Another one that's interesting is very notable during this interrogation scene between Paris and Janeway in Threshold. Very reminiscent of Silence of the Lambs and, of course, Hannibal Lecter and Clarice Starling's encounter there, I'd say. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't necessarily expect that those... At least the latter two movies that I mentioned had such a big influence on Star Trek, but there you go.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, another movie that is very much held in regard in terms of inspiring an episode of Voyager is the episode Macrocosm and the Alien franchise. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but back at the time this episode aired, a lot of people were pointing out that it was an Alien riff, right?
Yeah, I was on the message boards, and everybody's like, oh yeah, Janeway, she's Ripley now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, but Cam, don't you think there's more overt homage, not necessarily to Alien, but something else in that series?
Yeah, I really think Macrocosm is inspired by Aliens.
How so?
Because there are so many points that are similar to Aliens. Just the idea of Janeway and Neelix going back to the ship, it's completely deserted. They can't find anyone. Very much like the colony at the start of Aliens. And where do they find the crew? The crew are up in the, you know, in the mess hall, impregnated essentially with these like wounds on their necks and flies coming out. This is again like the colonists who are strapped up with the chest bursters coming out of them. You have similar just ideas. The phaser rifles, very similar to the ones used by the Marines in Aliens. And I believe you said this design had been around a while, but it's just kind of the matching of it in this episode is very on the nose. You also have like acid holes in the transporter. And really interesting shot. There's a moment where the Doctor is climbing the Jeffries tomb, and it looks a lot like Bishop climbing through that really claustrophobia-inducing metal pipe at the third act of Aliens.
Yeah. Any coincidence that it's artificial life forms in both cases?
No, it can't be. Impossible.
Okay.
You've also got like this really industrial score that's kind of reminiscent of James Horner's work in that for Aliens.
And James Horner, also that Star Trek connection.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the most obvious one, though, was Janeway, because Ripley is such an important character for the world of science fiction and for female representation. And, you know, Sigourney Weaver's importance in that role cannot be understated, and it makes sense that Janeway would take a lot from that, being the first female captain in Star Trek. And so, when you look at Ripley in Alien, she's a reactive character. She's kind of in that role of always kind of being chased. Whereas in Aliens, she's a badass. She's strapping on machine guns and flamethrowers, going in to get Newt. This is like Janeway, you know, strapping on those things, taking down multiple creatures, emphasis multiple, again, aliens, you know, to save her crew. It's much more like the warrior kind of mother figure that we see in Macrocosm and Aliens. But, you know, when I think of Alien, the original, I think actually more of the Season 6 episode of Voyager, Prey, which is the episode where there's the single member of a species 8472 gets on the ship, and there's that great shot of it on the outside of Voyager that feels very Ridley Scott Alien as opposed to James Cameron. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of the horror depends on the Voyager crew and this member of the Hirogen hunting party kind of going down these dark corridors. There's a lot of like horror atmosphere, and a lot of the drama comes from them squabbling with each other over, especially with Janeway and Seven of Nine, over how to deal with this situation. This is much more like the class conflict going on in Alien, at least as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I definitely think if listeners give those films and episodes a back-to-back watch, you definitely see how much closer Prey is to Alien and Aliens is to Macrocosm.
Mm-hmm, so. Mm-hmm.
Cam, you know, I think there's a couple more movies and episodes that we want to touch on that don't necessarily follow or fall into any particular category that we've outlined here.
At least none we could think of.
Well, we're both very slow, so that's right. Probably why. So let's call this a lightning round here.
Sure.
I'll just blast off a few, and then maybe you and I can go into more detail about a couple of these. But Frame of Mind, very notable Season 6 episode of Star Trek Next Generation, featuring Riker.
No!
Exactly. Very iconic. Go watch the film Repulsion.
Yeah, the 1968 Roman Polanski movie, yeah.
Similarities galore there.
Look for the shot where, in both the episode and the movie, a character is looking in the mirror.
Yeah. Cam, I don't think I'm shocking everybody if I bring up Armand Bashir, as well as the influence from the James Bond films.
Yeah, and the title comes from the Armand Flint, which is the James Coburn sort of James Bond spoofs. Armand Bashir is really interesting in how it mixes up sort of that love of 60s Bond, which was at its peak, and then like 90, kind of like Diamonds Are Forever, early 70s Bond, which is kind of like when Sean Connery was phoning it in and the movies got really campy.
Yeah.
As well as like the sort of the Bond spoof movement, like the Armand Flint movies, as well as like the 1967 Casino Royale.
Another one worth bringing up is Heart of Stone, in which Odo encounters Kira, who's slowly being consumed, and she's stuck by this growing crystal/rock. Go take a look at Sometimes a Great Notion, which is, of course, was a 1970s film directed by one Paul Newman. Very iconic instant in that particular movie in which a character is trapped underneath a log. A lot of decision-making about whether or not they can try to save that character there.
I've never seen that movie.
It's okay.
Okay.
There's a reason why maybe tons of people aren't talking about it. It almost feels like kind of like watching homework.
Right.
You know, like you can appreciate it. Is it going to grip you? Not necessarily so.
Right.
I haven't read the novel that it's based on, though. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why Paul Newman was inspired to direct this adaptation. So.
Yeah.
Another one, Face of the Enemy, probably my favorite Troy episode.
I thought it was The Child.
My second favorite Troy episode. Go watch that against Hunt for Red October. Cam, we should also maybe touch upon maybe one more controversial episodes. Prophet and Lace, in which Quark literally gets a sex change in order to make somebody think that he's a woman. I think that was a bit of an homage to Some Like It Hot. Yeah. I think this movie and Iris Stephen Bear, the writer, will even admit that it was a failure. And you watch it, you know, almost 20 years later, it's downright offensive.
Yeah, I mean, so when Somewhat Like It Hot was made in 1959, that premise felt kind of fresh, and it's a lot of fun. That movie is just an absolute blast. Has so much energy. Compare that to Profit and Lace.
Yeah.
I mean, it just feels like leaden and just doesn't work as a comedy. I always question, though, whether that episode happens if Mrs. Doubtfire doesn't explode at the box office in 93.
Very similar time period, so, you know, could be. One other one, Cupid, in which Q sends the crew to Sherwood Forest, very influenced by Adventures of Robin Hood. You're also coming off that whole Robin Hood Prince of Thieves era. Just look at Picard with that. I guess he's donning that Earl Flynn-like goatee look there.
Yeah.
And Cam, one of my favorite comedic moments in all of Star Trek, inspired by one, Animal House, in which Worf grabs Geordi's mandolin and smashes it against a tree. Everyone knows what moment I'm talking about
there. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I do want to touch upon this. All the President's Men, very strong influence on the episode In the Pale Moonlight, very iconic Deep Space Nine episode, is originally pitched as an All the President's Men kind of take, in which Jake would be investigating First Minister Shakar on Bajor for possible nefarious connections, and Ben Sisko would be roped in. The writers didn't really buy the conflict between Jake and Ben, so they rewrote it quite heavily, but you still see that influence of All the President's Men on that particular episode. I definitely see Garak as a kind of a deep throat character in that one. And guys, look, we're in Vegas right now at the Rio. We're having a good time. So how can I not bring up Ocean's 11? Bada bing, bada bang. Big influence there. Cam, is there any one particular film and episode you want
to? Yo, there's a couple I wanted to mention, and we should add that In the Pale Moonlight, of course, named after the movie Batman, Tim Burton's Batman from '89. So I want to talk just about some original series episodes. You have the Corbomite Maneuver with Balak and his puppet, very much inspired by The Wizard of Oz. Look at the framing of the puppet and the magnificent head of The Wizard of Oz in that film, and it's pretty unmistakable. It's kind of shocking, actually, when you look at it. A less obvious one, though, is the episode Galileo 7 from season 1 of original series is actually a remake of the 1939 movie Five Came Back, which is sort of the father or mother or whatever you want to say of disaster movies. It's about a group of people who are all from different walks of life. There's like the elderly kind of lovable couple, and then there's like a woman of ill repute who's played by Lucille Ball. Of course, Star Trek connection, Desilu Studios. And she plays like this kind of like, yeah, this bombshell character, which is very odd to see Lucille Ball in.
Yeah, not to me.
Well, there
you
go.
I always thought of her as a bombshell.
But they're on a plane that crash lands in South America, and they have to work together to kind of build the society. And they're always on the under threat from natives. And the movie was directed by John Farrow, who directed like the John Wayne B. Western Hondo and a movie called Wake Island. Not particularly a well-known guy. This is a B-movie, very much. And Galileo 7, though, very much inspired again by it. That's the episode where Spock and the crew crash land on Taurus 2. And Spock is in charge of this landing party. There's 7 of them. And they don't agree with Spock's leadership. And they're being hunted by natives who have like this leather that they're kind of pulling across these wooden weapons that's creating this unsettling sort of sound. And that's very reminiscent of the tribal drums in Five Came Back. In both cases, there's the idea of, like, when this sound stops, we're going to get attacked. Something bad is going to happen. So they're in this race against time to repair their craft and get out of there. And the general premise of Five Came Back is, you know, there's this... That 12 of them crash land, but because of the weight in the plane to fly out of there, only 5 are going to be able to go. And there's a lot of debate over who gets to go. And ultimately, it's an anarchist character that chooses the 5. And, you know, the idea of drawing straws comes up, but ultimately, he's the one who makes the choice. Now, Spock plays that role in Galileo 7, where 7 crash land. There's some fatalities, but ultimately, Spock has to choose which 4 get to leave. Star Trek cheats. This is an episode where Spock is often very unlikable and portrayed as a leader who's not necessarily polished. And so I think it would have been a bit iffy to have Spock leave a man behind to get killed by natives.
Yeah, I'm sure there were maybe a net, some network notes from
So they cheat, but it's still a really good episode. And, you know, anyone who watches TOS knows this is a very vital early Spock episode.
Yeah.
Let's jump to Next Generation for a really interesting one, I think, to close, because it's the episode Phantasms, which we've talked about on the podcast a few times. It's the episode where, you know, Data's having these surrealistic sort of David Lynchian fever dreams. And there's a moment in this episode where Data stabs Troy in an elevator. Now, you watch the scene, the way it's blocked and the sound effects, it's Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. And this episode is directed by Patrick Stewart, who I have to believe Hitchcock would have had a certain influence on him, just given his generation and being, you know, from Britain. What's interesting, though, about this episode, though,
I thought Patrick Stewart was French.
Good point. What's interesting about this episode, though, is that it bears a lot of the hallmarks also of 1980s Dress to Kill, the Brian De Palma movie. Now, but De Palma, who called himself the master of the macabre, one of the, if the greatest student of Hitchcock, has a scene in Dress to Kill where Angie Dickinson is stabbed in an elevator. Now, again, in an elevator versus a turbo lift in Next Generation, very similar. It also is preceded by this scene of Troy walking down this corridor, and it's kind of this dreamlike sort of weird scene of foreboding, which is very similar to Angie Dickinson earlier in Dress to Kill walking through an art museum, and it's just like something feels a little off and uncertain, and it feels like this character is kind of doomed. So I think, you know, Psycho influence is obvious. It's there, for sure. The Dress to Kill one is more of a question mark?
I think we had a good question to ask Patrick Stewart next time he's at a convention, which he doesn't really attend that many of nowadays.
So. Do you think he would remember?
That's another question that we might want to ask, because we saw him last year in Vegas. He had a whole lot of missing memories, I did notice.
Yeah,
so to ask him something so specific about something he directed, like, almost 25 years ago? Almost 30 years ago?
Yeah.
I don't know. It might be tough.
Yeah, it's just, this to me is like one of those burning mysteries I'll always wonder about.
Yeah.
Kind of like whether Shatner improv the fist clench fire in Star Trek VI.
Well, we'll have Nicholas Meyer on the show soon enough, and we can find out for sure.
Yeah, he'll be hyping Star Trek Discovery here.
I can't wait.
Yeah. So, you know, that was the panel, essentially, we did in Vegas. And we just want to both thank Creation Entertainment for letting us do this, especially on the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. And, I mean, wow.
Yeah, it was an honor. We had a good time. We didn't embarrass ourselves. There's some technical issues. You know, my mic was a little wonky at times. The PowerPoint presentation sputtered out about two-thirds of the way in. But, hey, them's the breaks, right?
For sure. That's show business.
Yeah. But, no, we actually, the IT guy, or audiovisual guy who's helping us out, he kept saying, hey, just let me know what I can do for you. I'm here to help you. So I really want to give a shout-out to Doug. Thank you very much, Doug.
Yeah, and thanks to everyone who came and saw us. We actually had a much bigger crowd than we really expected, I think, especially for a morning panel.
Almost half a dozen.
And, you know, thanks for just the feedback we got. And we hope that, you know, all of you enjoyed hearing this panel. We put a lot of work into it. This obviously isn't our typical podcast, but we just felt it was important. We put a lot of work into this, so we got to, you know, kind of milk it for a while.
And like you mentioned at the very beginning, people were, we had a Q&A session at the end of this, and people were coming up to the mic and like asking, hey, where can I find this information? We even had one of the audience members, Anise, she was like, hey, I love your podcast now. Are you guys going to do like another kind of recording that I could download of this? Mm-hmm. And I think that really, to see that people are actually interested in this, it was kind of inspiring, and we figured, hey, let's do it for the fans.
That's right.
The fans of us, not Star Trek.
Sure. So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. send us your thoughts on some of the movie connections, maybe that we missed or didn't talk about. I'd love to respond to some of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or call us out on some of these that you maybe don't agree with. That would be interesting, too.
Well, during the Q&A session, we had one audience member point out an interesting one, Field of Fire, Season 7, Deep Space Nine episode. She really saw a lot of connections between Ezri and a former host, and the Clarice Starling-Hannibal Lecter relationship is something I'd never even thought about, but as soon as the audience member brought it up, I was like, oh, you are 100% right.
Yeah.
So, guys, try to top her, please.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Yeah, but Cam, next week we're going to have a fun episode. This is something we recorded in Vegas with a lot of our good pals there. We call it the Klingon Blood Wine Games.
Yes, this was originally planned to kind of be like our 100th episode celebration, but it just didn't work out time-wise. So we did it in Las Vegas, live in Las Vegas, which is maybe more exciting.
Yeah.
We made a bigger event out of it, and I think it was a lot of fun. It's sort of an experiment for the podcast, and who knows, we could see more things like that down the road if you guys enjoy it. So
even if you don't enjoy it, I had enough fun. I'm going to push you to do more of this Quizmaster sort of stuff, Cam.
Sounds good.
Okay.
So you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Voyage, comma, Fantastic, Smith.
Well, you can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N-N as in noir, comma, film.
So until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.